Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery for another action-packed Avenger. Avenger, not adventure. Yeah. Right. This is Al Warren, of course, and that's... sidecar Martino
right, shotgun.
Yeah, shotgun. Yeah, he's the gun drinking man, right? I forget about that.
Yeah, that's right.
and we've got a new guy that's been joining us. That's you know, he was a very interesting guest, and so we had to bring him along, and now he's kind of hanging through, and he's our Southern reporter, Mr. He's known as D.W. Gillespie, but we call him Dusty.
Yes, reporting from the front lines of the Mason-Dixon line. I don't know.
There you go.
Well, it won't be long. Something will be going on down there. You're paid to watch, so just watch. You never know. See what's coming by your window any day now. So, well, today we'll jump into it because we've got a guest here that's waiting on the line, and he's got an interesting lineup of books. Let's just bring him in, Mr. Stuart Gibbs. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, fantastic. Let's see now. Your newest book, Spy School, the graphic novel. Before we get into that, I have to say, how did you get into writing novels for kids?
That was not my intention. I had always wanted to be an author, but I had thought that I would be writing for adults, and I tried throughout many, many years trying to publish for adults, and had kind of set that aside for a while, and the whole book world, I was working in the movie business. And at some point, about now maybe 13 years ago, all the writers went on strike. And so I reached out to my agency and said, could I talk to someone in the book division? And so they put me in touch with an agent named Jennifer Joel. And Jennifer called me up and said, hey, have you ever thought about writing middle grade fiction? And it seems kind of nuts because up until that very moment, I had not. And then I thought about it and I thought, oh my gosh, I have all these ideas that would actually work really well if I wrote them as middle grade. And the very first one was was a mystery set at a zoo involving a murdered hippopotamus, which I thought that would be investigated by a young zoo vet. But then I realized, hey, this is a great crime for a kid to solve because, you know, sometimes when kids are solving crimes in books, you're thinking, why is this kid not going to the police? And I figured, well, he could go to the police and say somebody murdered the hippo and they're not going to take him seriously. So then he's going to have to investigate himself. So that was sort of the beginning of that whole journey. My son was two at the time. So I thought, oh, great. If I write a book for him, he'll be able to read it in, you know, 5 or 6 years and not 18 years. So I thought maybe I write one middle grade, and that's now turned into something like 25 of them.
That the path that you're describing is almost scary compared to like where I'm at right now, because I've been writing horror fiction for, you know, forever at this point. And I've written two middle grade kind of scary books. And one of them is, you know, I'm getting some traction on it right now. So it's pretty exciting. And one of the things that I'm dealing with is a good question for you is when you made that transition from writing for adults to writing for kids, was it an easy, seamless transition? Did you kind of catch yourself having to go back and rewrite some things and be like, eh, maybe that was more adult than it should have been?
You know, when I didn't ever want to write down to the kids. You know, there were a few things that you would write for adults that you wouldn't necessarily write for kids, you know, again, to go back to Belly Up, in one of the early drafts, I hadn't included something that hippos do that I thought was funny. They do something called dung showering, where they basically spray a field of poo and use their tails like a little windshield wiper and just, you know, take out anybody close by. And I was talking to my editor, and I described this, and I said, I don't know if this is the sort of thing I should be writing about for children. And he said, that's exactly the sort of thing you should be writing about for children. And so I was kind of like, all right, I found my level. This is great. So there's not too many topics that I can't touch for kids, really.
That's what Dave does, you know.
I knew it was coming.
Well, you know, I have to. So what do you set out for a goal when you're writing that one of these spy books for kids? What is it you are trying to get across to the kids?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm just really trying to provide them a good story. And, you know, I mean, I guess when I'm writing for kids, I'm still trying to write something that I would enjoy reading either to my kids or just as an adult on my own. You know, I don't have a tremendous agenda in a lot. I do like to talk about threats to the environment in some of my books or to specific animals. But I, you know, a big part of, I think if I was going to have like one message in all the books, it would kind of be that, you know, there's no shame in being smart. That's what I've always loved about mysteries, right? There are stories where the smartest person wins. But a lot of the time, the way that a really smart person is depicted on television or the movies is this sort of social misfit, like the idea you can't be really smart without having something slightly off about you. And that's not how smart people really are in real life. The really smart people I know are adventurous and dynamic and athletic and often very, very funny. And so I wanted to have characters like that in my books and have heroes who are respected for being smart and who, you know, won friends and admiration of other people for their intelligence.
Well, do you need to get into a certain headspace to write for children? Do you have to kind of get into the mind of a child to write stories for children?
A little bit, especially writing first person, you've got to sort of, you know, like I can write for, you know, like a protagonist who's a young boy because I was a young boy. Mm. My daughter would tell me that I still behave like a child sometimes. I have a series, Charlie Thorne, Charlie's a Girl, and I didn't want to do that one in first person because I didn't really want to presume what was going through the mind of a 12-year-old girl, but I have a pretty good idea of what a 12-year-old boy is thinking a lot of the time. So, but it is a bit of, you do have to sort of age yourself down a little bit, think like, what was I thinking when I was this age, or what would I have thought was cool? How would I have dealt with a bully? How would I have dealt with being in danger? And, that's actually a point in life where you can still pretty much remember being 12. It's not like being 5 or something. It's not the most difficult thing to put myself in a kid's, the mind of a 12 or 13 year old boy.
I have a problem remembering what day it is. just saying, you know. So when you were writing for adults and you were doing kind of, if you're writing more of an adult crime fiction or something like that, do you find that the characters you create for your books are completely different? Like, do you feel about them differently?
Well, gosh, it's been so long since, I think, you know, your protagonist, if you're writing, you know, a 12-year-old, I do try to make my 12-year-olds maybe a little more erudite than a normal 12-year-old might be, and speaking a little closer to how I might speak as an adult. I think that, you know, beyond, like if you've got somebody who's trying to solve a mystery, you're still going to have that sort of same righteousness of like, I've got to solve this crime, and interest in the world of where that crime is taking place, and so I don't know that a 12-year-old is that far off from, say, is a 12-year-old really different from a 50-year-old? Yeah. Is a 12-year-old that different from somebody who's in their early 20s? Maybe not that much. Right. When I read the Spy School series, I have this idea that Ben, who's my hero, Ben Ripley, who's sort of been thrust into this kind of James Bond world, or a world where all he really knows about spying is James Bond movies and Mission Impossible movies, and then finds out the world doesn't really work like that. He's often having the same reactions that I think I would have in that scenario. So if somebody hands Ben a grappling hook and says, "You know how to use this, don't you?" Ben's response is, "Nobody knows how to use a grappling hook. That's not, there's no grappling hook section at Target, right?" So whether or not he's 12 or he's an adult like me, like, that reaction is going to be pretty much the same.
Right. Yeah, certainly would be. What's the premise behind Spy School? Like, you've got a series of these books. What is Spy School?
So Spy School, the idea is that Ben has been recruited to the CIA's top secret Academy of Espionage, which is a secret facility to train the spies of tomorrow. One of my conceits in the book is that, it sounds really cool, but then you realize that a government-run school is everything you hated about school and the government combined. Ben finds out very quickly in the first book that he hasn't even been brought in because he's qualified to get there. He's been brought in as bait to catch a mole, and he's really been kind of thrown to the wolves, and it really needs to prove, he needs to find the mole, not just to prove that he belongs there, but also to stay alive. Luckily, he's able to team up with the best student in spy school, Erica Hale, who that's her family business, is spying. They go all the way back to Nathan Hale in the American Revolution. So Erica, because she's a legacy, is actually quite adept at spying. And so she teams up with Ben to sort of figure out who the mole is and save the day. And then because of that success, that sort of lays the groundwork for them to go on more missions throughout the series. The idea of the series is that normally these young spies would not be going on missions, but there's a set of unusual circumstances which have thrust Ben into going on one mission after another throughout the course of the series.
Well, I'm wondering, your latest Spy School is a graphic novel. I'm just wondering how it was for you to work with an illustrator. And in writing that, was it more like writing a movie script?
It was actually, it's funny you should say that, because I wasn't sure how one wrote the script for a graphic novel. So because it's so visual, I did just write the movie script version of the book. And I handed that off to Anjan Sarkar, who is my tremendously talented illustrator. And Anjan really took it from there. And he did all the layout. He did every piece of illustration there with really not that much. I didn't need to give that much input. I was just pleased with everything he did.
Yeah, I was going to ask. You kind of answered the question before I even got it out. But what's the editing process look like when you have kind of a vision for a scene? Is it kind of just more on his shoulders to make that work?
You know, I was allowed into the editing process. They did send me, pages to look at. That was my publisher. But what was actually really fascinating to me was that the art director at my publisher, Simon Schuster, Lucy Cummins, was involved too. And Lucy is incredibly talented. She actually does all the covers for all my books, which is unusual for, like, usually she finds other people do it. And she's created this incredibly iconic spy guy for the cover of the Spy School series. And so she was in on this, giving notes on the pages, and she was coming at it. I was really coming at it from a, sort of a literal storytelling thing. And Lucy was coming at it from a very visual standpoint. And to see her notes, which were so visual, they were about things that would have never occurred to me. And so so I was usually just sort of rubber stamping Lucy's notes, saying like, oh gosh, that's really cool. The one thing I think I realized in looking was the need for kind of establishing shots, and that I hadn't really thought of when I was first writing the screenplay of the graphic novel, was to say like, oh, let's have like sort of those, which I realized going back and looking at graphic novels and comics, it's pretty standard to sort of introduce a setting. That's one of the fun things you can do with a graphic novel is have this great big scene where you're showing a place, and then sort of have the little speech bubbles coming out. So you can have a conversation going. You know, in a movie, you can't really have a conversation of two characters while you're showing an establishing shot. But in a graphic novel, you can. You can have the big overview and then still have a conversation going on throughout it. And then sort of use that as a little segue into get closer to the characters on the next in the next panel, and get even closer on the next panel. So that was something I realized I could do. But for the most part, it was Lucy saying like, why don't you put two characters in this panel? Why don't you do this panel from more of an angle? And she was probably right most of the time, but it would never have been something I would have even thought to ask for.
So what do you do to keep up with the trends going on with children and kids and stuff like that? You know, the music, what they wear, what they think is cool, because it's quite different than what it was when we were kids.
Well, I think that the trend thing is a little tricky, because, you know, there's always this fear that if you write something that's too of the moment, then in 4 years, it'll seem dated. And I do mention things like Twitter and Instagram, but I'm always a little wary of even doing that, because I'm just thinking, gosh, you know, in a couple of years, that's not going to be a thing. So I'm cautious to ever get too steeped into what's really going on right now. Because, and of course, you know, as kids, they have zero memory of anything that happened, particularly, if you're talking to a 12-year-old and say like, okay, well, here's what 12-year-olds like 5 years ago, that means like nothing to them. So you really don't want to end up, talking about a fad that's gone. So you sort of look for things that you think like, okay, this is here to stay. Like I'm pretty sure that mobile phones are not going anywhere anytime soon. So I can talk about those and certain apps, or the fact that people play games on their phones, but I won't mention a specific game because, that'll be gone by the time the book comes out, possibly.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't take long, 20 years, everything we're doing now will be completely different, I guess, as far as things like that, phones and all of that stuff. And how do you keep up with kids and how they think, as in what they talk about, or you don't really get that much into it?
Well, I do. I mean, I you know, I have a focus group in my own home because I have I've got teenagers who are you know, aging kind of out of that, but you know, there's but it gives me a foot in that world, and I do talk to a lot of schools, and that's a huge part of writing a middle grade, which nobody told me about when I started out. I found that out like even after the first book published, that the publisher was like, okay, you're off to do school visits. And I was like, what? What do I say? And they're like, I don't know, just say whatever you want to say. So, but now I've been doing this for years, and that's actually a really good way to see what kids are into and what excites them. And my readers, write to me a lot. They write to me on my webpage. I've got an email that they can just write to. They do communicate through social media, and that actually does give me a real window on. They will suggest things and say, like, I think, you know, this is important. You ought to think about this. I don't really take suggestions from young readers, but if I do get the idea that there's something in the zeitgeist that they are all really thinking about, then I'll kind of go like, okay, that's important to them. That's something I really need to consider.
You mentioned earlier that you know, your family kind of jokes that you're the kid of the family, and my family definitely does the same to me too. And I'm finding that as I'm moving into the middle grade stuff, that it's stuff that I loved when I was a kid. It's a natural transition of like, hey, I like monster books, so I'm writing those for kids now. Were you into like spies and James Bond and all that stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, everything. I'm the same boat as you. Everything I write about is something that fascinated me as a kid. So I loved James Bond movies. As a kid, I actually read a lot of the James Bond novel. I had that rude awakening. That's how I discovered that the book and the movie are often nothing alike, that through James Bond. I loved animals and going to the zoo. I loved space travel as a kid. I actually I wrote to NASA and volunteered to be the first kid to go into space, and I got rejected. But... No, they haven't sent a kid up, but I'm writing about, you know, that now. So just about anything I write about is something that fascinated me as a child.
Yeah.
And I still am fascinated by it. I haven't given up. It stayed with me. And so I just write about things that I'm like, okay, I think kids would find this really interesting.
It's interesting. When you go to the other set of novels you're doing, the Charlie Thorne one, you were saying that, because the lead character is a girl, you don't write it from first person. How do you attack a book like that? How do you put that out?
Well, I did, you know, for Charlie Thorne, I did by that point want to do something in third person anyhow, because I wanted to just tell the story differently, get the, you know, show what the bad guys were up to, or, you know, just shift perspectives in the story a bit. But to have a 12-year-old girl, you know, I really did have to show it to some other women writers I knew and say, like, did I get this character right? And it was kind of fun to see what they would come back with. Like, I have a very good friend who's an author named Sarah Mlynowski, and Sarah said, oh, you should do something, like, you know, she has long hair. I'm like, yeah. She's like, then it's going to get in her face all the time. Like, you know, give her, you know, it's going to be important to, you know, that she has to have a scrunchie or something like that. And I was like, yeah, I never would have thought of that if I hadn't had this advice. But there's actually sort of like a running thing about her hair and getting a scrunchie as it goes on. So you know, I wouldn't necessarily show my other books to a guy and say, hey, do you think I got this kid right? But with writing for with a girl protagonist, I really felt I had to do that.
Well, I'm wondering, when you're writing dialogue for your characters, or even if you're writing a screenplay, I was wondering how you experience your characters. Do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear your characters? Is that how you write dialogue, or do you do it some other way?
Oh no, I can really hear them. I like to have a general thought of where my conversation's going, but I think that, you know, I have a very distinct idea of how my characters speak and their attitudes and their takes on things. And so sometimes I really do like to just get to the scene, and I haven't really, I just know it needs to get from a.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
To B to C, and I'll just sort of sit down and imagine, you know, how all the characters go. And so, like, the dialogue sequences haven't been that outlined beforehand. I'm just writing down how all the characters would react to each other and what they would say. And it can be, I mean, like, because I've gone down the road with a lot of these, and I'm pretty far down in the series. Like, I can, you know, a lot of the time that it's almost like a little improv scene in my head where the characters are saying different stuff, and I'll have one character say something, and then I'll immediately ad lib the answer from another character in my head and be like, oh, that's really good. That's exactly what that character would say now, and it's funny. I hope it's fun.
What, do these characters tell you to do weird things?
Well, every once in a while, I've had a conversation sort of go in a weird direction, and you know, but it's kind of fun to see where it goes. And do I always use it? No, but sometimes there's some stuff that's come up, and I'm like, oh man, right. It was only from that sort of imagining their conversation in the moment that I got to that place, and it can work out really well sometimes.
So have you? I know you mentioned earlier the hippo example. Have there been any circumstances where you've written a scene or a dialogue or anything like that where the publisher kind of pushed back and said, you know what, that is too much for kids?
Well, oddly, to get to the graphic novel, there's a big difference between describing a gun and showing a gun.
Yeah.
And which also came up as Spy School has been back and forth in development as a movie, and the exact same issue came up there. And so you're constantly saying, well, what can I, you know, You know, can we hear a gunshot? Can we, you know, see the little bursts of, like, you know, as bullets are hitting, you know, the ground? You know, that's fine. And in both the movie and the graphic novel, there's a scene at the end of the book where the bad guy, Ben, has finally caught the mole, and the mole has a gun trained on him, which is pretty standard in spy movies. And that was just not going to fly in either the book or the movie. And so I had actually been developing the movie first, and I said, well, you know, what can I use instead of a gun? And they were like, well, how about a flamethrower? I was like, a flamethrower? Isn't it like 1,000 times worse than a gun, right? Like, That's horrible what a flamethrower would do to somebody. And they're like, no, flamethrower is fine. So in the graphic novel, I gave the bad guy a flamethrower, and I can get a joke out of it, a couple jokes out of it later on. But it's, you know, it's almost ridiculous that there's a flamethrower instead of a gun, and that's okay for kids, but it is. And so that's been, that is sort of a recurring issue because now I've done one Spy School graphic novel, the rest of the books are all coming. And I just started working on sort of the script for the third book. And I was going through the book, and I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much gunfire in this book for kids that nobody ever said anything about. My hero never holds a gun, I should point out. That was a conscious choice that I never wanted Ben. I actually made him terrible with a weapon, so that, like, nobody even wants him anywhere near one. But it was important to me that he solve his problems by thinking his way through them instead of shooting his way out of them. And so he never holds one, so that wasn't a big issue. But there's a lot of bad guys who have a lot of guns throughout the series, and it's not really ever been an issue until now.
There's a, which my kids are young too, so I see a lot of, you know, kids media that I probably wouldn't have otherwise, but that's some of the feedback that I've gotten too, is that it seems like the trend now, you know, when I grew up in the 80s, and it was like, the bad guy's the bad guy, it's okay to use violence to stop them, and so now the trend is more like, well, the bad guy's misunderstood, so they're actually good, and isn't that okay? Let's fix them instead of, like, you know, taking them out.
Right. You know, I blame for this is George Lucas, because George Lucas did a whole prequel series for Star Wars to explain why Darth Vader was bad, and my son, even at the end of it, was like, I don't understand why he's bad. I was like, yeah, well, that's not good. But at some point we were having a conversation when he was younger, and he was like, you know, Darth Vader really wasn't that bad a guy. You know, he just had this, like, little period. And I was like, no, he's the worst father ever. He was a terrible person. And the idea that George Lucas went back and said, yeah, he wasn't that bad, and here's how and now you just have this huge trend of movies saying, oh, here's why Cruella de Vil is bad, and here's why the Joker's bad, and all this yes. stuff. And you're like, no, they were just evil. And I mean, like, actually, Patton Oswalt has a fantastic routine about, like, just give me what I want, just give me the bad guys, and don't tell me all of this. And so he compares it to like somebody like George Lucas showing him how to make ice cream instead of just giving him the ice cream. He's like, I don't care about the rock salt and everything. Just give me the damn ice cream.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I really do like just the bad guy's the bad guy. And there's not that nuance is bad, but it's just interesting now that I'm headed that direction too, that I'm getting that same kind of feedback of, like, well, could they have a different way to fix this problem besides, you know, taking out the bad guy? And I'm like, sometimes the bad guy just needs to be taken out.
Yeah. I know. In Spy School, I have a recurring bad guy, and what I love writing him because he's just so happy to be bad. And I'm like, I'm never going to explain it. I'm never going to be, he's in it for the money. He's just pointing out, like, how much an idiot anybody who's good is, because they're slogging away, and their benefits are terrible or whatever. And he's just happy to be bad. I'm like, I love writing that character because he's so much. But if anybody ever said, hey, could you explain, like, what happened to him as a kid? I'd be like, no, I don't want to explain that. I just want him to be bad.
Well, I don't think you need that. You know, because when I was young, you had the Rocky and Bullwinkle and all those things.
Right.
And they're just bad.
Right. Yeah. No, there's so much fun, you know, to, yeah, right. I mean, like, goodness knows if they ever, like, say, oh, we're going to remake Die Hard and show how, like, why Hans Gruber's a bad guy. You're like, no, that'd be terrible.
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't
and,
want
and to. And actually, I guess, right. I mean, the James Bond just went down that road with Blofeld and said, like, you know, okay, here, you know, oh, he was friends with James when he was little. And you're like, oh, no, don't tell us why Blofeld is Blofeld. Just let him be a jerk.
Yeah, yeah, I could. I don't want to see a prequel for Rocky and Bullwinkle and only have Rocky in a room talking about how bad his father was to him.
Right, right,
you know, it's like, no, it doesn't work. You don't need that. I think you just sort of have that feeling of what it is, of who's bad, and they do bad things, you know, and stuff. Or on that same line, do you have to worry about how let's say, how violent or how you word things?
I do have to watch out for that, and I, you know, I don't really kill characters off, or if they go, they sort of go in this sort of bloodless, like, off-screen sort of version of, you know, for a book. I always, as a kid, I did always like the fact that there was, like, a character like Jaws in James Bond who just couldn't be killed. No matter how ridiculous that was. And so I do have bad guys in the Spy School series who should have been dead like 9 times over, but are not, because that's just funny to me. And it is odd because sometimes kids, I won't ever hear this from adults, but kids will write to me and they'll be like, hey, you know, I think it would be really emotionally powerful if you killed off like one of the main characters. And I'm like, I am not doing that. Why do you think that? Like, you know, so, and I guess it does happen in, you know, that there have been some, you know, at least one major character in the Harry Potter series who dies at some point. But I'm just like, I don't think it gains me anything to kill off anybody. And so even if somebody looks like they died, there's always a relatively decent chance that they didn't really die.
I was going to ask too about, is that it, when I think about something like Harry Potter, where that did get darker and darker and yeah, we're killing characters off for good and all that kind of stuff. It was almost like she was writing it. The characters were growing up as the readership was growing up. Did that happen in this series, or were you kind of staying focused on the demo?
I'm staying, you know, J.K. Rowling had just a really unusual circumstance where her books just became a phenomenon as she was writing them. And so she did sort of scale them up, you know, every year, and the books got darker and darker. But that actually makes that a relatively difficult. I know it's a super popular series, but it was hard to get my kids into that series. Because the first one, which is a wonderful book, is written for so much younger a kid than the older books, and she's really the only person who's ever done that. Even the really successful series, for middle grade, like Diary of a Wimpy Kid or Percy Jackson, just they really all stayed in the middle grade world. And so even though I'm at book 10 now, book 10 is coming. My characters are staying relatively close to the same age, which means that the adventures all have to happen within a couple of weeks of each other. They are aging. My kids are aging. They're not like the Hardy Boys, where somehow they're sort of trapped in amber and never get any older. But they're aging slowly so that I can keep them in middle grade.
What kind of structure do you use, especially when you're writing a series like this? How do you keep this all in your head? Is this all previously outlined? You kind of know where you're going right through and kind of fill it in, or like, how does this work?
Well, I didn't know this was going to be a series when I started, and it was a joy to have the first book work out and so get a second. Series is getting more and more popular, and I do love writing it. So it kind of, you know, like if I were to think like, oh gosh, book 20, that seems like a lot, but I don't know. I haven't really worked out where it ends, but generally I'm thinking about 2 books ahead. So when I'm working on one book, I'm playing around with ideas for the next ones and where it could go and what could happen with the characters. And I do have a now quite a thick book Bible, which is sort of keeping track of everybody. But that said, it's not 100% accurate. I mean, not accurate is not right. The book Bible is accurate. My ability to use it isn't 100% accurate. So it does get harder and harder to keep track of everything as the story goes. And every single thing that's happened, especially when I wrote some of the books, 10 years ago.
Wow, that's great. It's quite the process here. So now you say you like to interact with people. How do you like to interact? Like, what social media do you do? Are you on TikTok?
I'm not on TikTok yet. No, that's a little too trendy for me. I'm sort of following, because my readers are young, and so they're really not supposed to be, a lot of them are under 13 and are probably not supposed to be using a lot of social media. So a lot of them tend to be on Instagram, which I think even that you're supposed to be 13, but I think a lot of people have fake accounts. And it's easy. It's just pictures and you like pictures and stuff. So I actually probably have the most interaction with my readers through my website, though, and through them commenting on the blog and then writing to me individually through an email that I have on the web. So I have a frequently asked questions page on the website. I try to put as much information that kids want to know on the website as possible. But that's probably the way that I can have the most sort of in-depth interaction with kids. There are some wikis and some fan sites, and I will occasionally go on and snoop around on those just to see what people are thinking about things, but compared to being a screenwriter, you never had any interaction with fans per se, I've been kind of shocked by how much interaction I do get with kids who read, and it can come in through it can come in through Twitter, it can come in through Goodreads. There are all these different avenues. And what also is interesting is the number of kids I hear from other countries. And a lot of them, I think, they don't have as many avenues to get to me. So I'll hear from a lot more kids from Iran over Instagram than I will through my website.
Well, you mentioned writing screenplays, and we've had a lot of writers who have had books turned into movies, but I was just wondering, what your experience was writing directly for Hollywood.
I did it when I was younger, Hollywood was, it was fun. I started writing kickboxing movies,
Showdown.
And yeah. Well, And it was fun to like write these sort of, movies that were shooting for, a couple $100,000 in a couple of days, but they were just cranking these things out. Then as I got into the studio system, it was fun to write, but it actually was kind of ultimately frustrating because so many projects just fall apart in Hollywood. So when the time came to write a book, when I actually had a book contract, there's sort of a thing my publisher still likes to remind me of that I turned in the final draft of Belly Up, and they're like, okay, it'll come out in 6 months. And I was like, yeah, but when everything goes wrong, I'll understand. And they're like, no, it's going to go wrong. I was like, I've heard that a million times, right? But the books come out, and that's fantastic. And so the mindset of writing something that is absolutely going to come out, as opposed to writing something you think has like a 1 in 10 chance of coming out, of getting made, and even less chance than that of coming out, or coming out the way that you envisioned it. I know that different people have different journeys in the film business, but my journey in the film business, while I actually enjoyed it, I certainly am enjoying writing novels more, because I just love the idea that whatever I write basically is going to end up in a book and in the way that I envisioned it.
How long does it take you to get one completed?
It is about, you know, I do a lot of brainstorming and outlining and researching before I sit down. So that whole process is I'm really playing around with a book idea for at least a year before I do it. And then once I've got an outline I like, it's probably somewhere between 3 and 6 months to do the first draft. And then there'll be probably another 8 to 10 drafts over the ensuing year.
Wow. That's quite the process. So how do people get a hold of you again? What's your website so we can...
So the website is just stuartgibbs.com.
Fantastic. We'll have that up on ours as well.
Oh, great. Yeah, yeah. And you know, like I said, there are frequently asked questions there. Sometimes I have a blog post where I try to address questions that I get a lot more in depth. And if people still can't find the answers they want, there is an email address at the bottom of the fact page.
Yeah, if they can't figure it out, then too bad. Well, and so I guess you stay away from things like COVID and all these things going on too. Any stressful thing going on around, you don't touch that, do you?
Yeah, well, you know, right when COVID first started, it was very common for readers to say, are you going to do something set during COVID? But that was like the seminal event of their entire lives, right? And I, you know, it was a weird thing to kind of be saying to kids, look, I know you think this is going to be the most important thing, but in 20 years, you're going to look back and be like, oh, yeah, that happened, right? Like, I mean, hopefully there won't be another pandemic or, you know, sometimes there is something that just, certainly not to say that COVID wasn't disruptive, but I didn't want to write a book about it because I thought, oh, you know, if I make a spy school happen during the time of COVID, by the time the book comes out, like, theoretically, the world will have gotten somewhere closer to normal. And maybe the last thing a kid's going to want to do is read about COVID or something. So I do try to skate around like the major issues of the day. I do take on global or climate change because that's not going away anytime soon. And I think or environmental impacts of things. And I do try to make I don't shy away from that stuff. But something that I think is kind of a temporary issue. I don't try to chase that any more than I try to, you know, work Minecraft into a story because it'll be gone somewhere.
Yeah, sort of like a trend, right? Something that can go, stuff like that. Wow. Yeah, like
COVID, that crazy trend.
Yeah.
You know, remember we all had it?
We all had COVID hair, come on. It was all that way, you know, I don't know. Well, it's fascinating actually to hear about this type of writing and stuff. What's the favorite thing about writing books like this for you?
You know, given that I did not know how much interaction there would be with my readers, that's really it. I am getting like the festival circuit is starting back up again. And I'm about to go off to one of my favorite, teen book festivals. And it's so great to see so many kids who are excited about reading, who are excited to meet authors. They don't have to be excited to meet me. It's just any author they want. It's great to actually, the other thing is that I've managed to create this great community of other middle grade and YA authors, and that we've all become very good friends over the years. And I think we all really did help each other through the pandemic, through Zooms and being there for each other. But they're always a great resource. It's always great to get to see them. So between getting to know the readers and getting to know other authors, those are sort of the great two things about this job.
Fantastic. Okay, so now the Spy School, the graphic novel, is out now. I guess
it is.
And you've got another one of your Charlie Thorne coming out.
Yes.
I guess that's June 1st, you said?
Charlie Thorne and the Curse of Cleopatra is out, I believe it's June 6th or 7th.
Yeah. Wow. Curse of Cleopatra.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Charlie is always on the trail of things that the greatest thinkers from throughout history have discovered and hidden away because they're too dangerous to trust humanity with. And my original thoughts on this were the first book involved Einstein, the second one involved Darwin, and I did really want to put a woman in there, and I was thinking about Marie Curie or Jane Goodall or one of the, but I read Stacey Schiff's amazing biography of Cleopatra, which, you know, basically posits that Cleopatra may have been the most educated woman of all time at her time, and certainly was a great leader of Egypt, and spoke at least seven languages, and is just sort of all around brilliant. And so I thought, like, that, and she lived at the intersection of the decline of the Egyptian Empire and the Greek Empire and the rise of the Roman Empire. There was just so much great stuff to write about. So Charlie's off to find something that Cleopatra hid away.
It's pretty interesting. I think that would be a very, very good book. That sounds good. Wow.
I hope it is. I feel like it's pretty good so far.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, it's been a great conversation. Again, the book, Spy School, the graphic novel. And our guest is the author of all these Spy School books, Stuart Gibbs. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank all of you guys for being such great hosts. I really appreciate getting to talk with you, and it's been really fun.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks. Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.